Thanks very much, Jeremy, and for that introduction, and thanks very much, Hugh, for hosting us here today. So it's a pleasure to speak at this launch of the ACFS's work on financial integration in the Asia-Pacific. I've had some first-hand experience on financial integration through the work through the Asian Bond Fund Initiative, which worked on with a bunch of central banks throughout Asia. So in particular, we launched the Asian Bond Fund 2 and the Pan-Asian Index Fund, which is still out there, a decade ago now, actually. It's coming up our 10th anniversary. So through that process, we've got direct exposure to some of the impediments to financial integration in the region, particularly both regulatory and tax. So we worked back 10 years ago to reduce some of those impediments, and which helped to pave the way for an expansion in cross-border fixed income flows in the region, which has seen a bunch of cross-border Asian fixed income funds proliferate throughout the region, taking away some of the funds which might otherwise have gone into the PAIF. But anyway, the idea was to reduce the impediments, and which we did, but it gave us a good insight into what the barriers are to financial integration in this part of the world. So what I'd like to do today briefly is just talk about some issues that come to mind when thinking about financial integration, both in Asia and globally. So in doing so, my aim is to pose questions which that the ACFS work might consider, although I'm not going to provide any answers, that's for them to do. So the first issue is about developments over the past decade or so, which show that financial integration is not a monotonic process. So it's not always onwards and upwards. So if you think about integration, the presumption is always that you're going to become more integration. But actually, as it's been shown over since 2008, financial integration is not always in one direction. So in particular, cross-border banking flows declined steeply in 2008 and 2009 and have in aggregate continued to shrink until only in the last 6 months or so. So we had a large period of financial integration or increasing financial integration up until 2008. That's been reversed up until the last year or so. So interestingly, in this part of the world, though, cross-border flows involving Chinese and Japanese banks have been increasing, while those elsewhere, particularly in Europe, have been declining. And we're seeing that firsthand here in Australia, with lending by Chinese and Japanese banks into Australia growing rapidly, albeit from a low base, particularly in the case of China. But lending from European banks has been declining. So some Chinese banks have obtained Australian banking licenses while some European banks have given them up. So notwithstanding what Jeremy said, it's now the case that lending by Chinese and Japanese banks is larger than lending by European banks in Australia. In light of these developments, one question that's worth thinking about is whether there is such a thing as an optimal degree of financial integration. Can there be too much of it? And the experience of the financial crisis shows that at least some forms of financial integration didn't go too well. So relatedly, what is the most beneficial form of financial integration? Is it cross-border banking flows? And if so, should those flows be through a branch or a subsidiary? And depending on which one you go down, you have different regulatory environments. Are bank-to-bank flows more problematic than direct bank lending by foreign banks directly into the domestic economy? So as I said, there are some of the questions which this sort of work might think about. You know, are banking flows the right way to go about financial integration? So the experience of cross-border banking is also replete with examples of the last mover disadvantage. So the general argument mounted in favour of cross-border banking is that it allows a bank to profitably utilise its knowledge, systems and skills in a new market. But is that best done by partnering with an existing bank in the home country or entering the market on your own? So while there may be opportunities that arise with a better banking model, it can also be the case that all the good borrowers are already taken. So the local banks already have well-established relationships with the customers, with the strong balance sheets, and it may be quite difficult to compete them away or wean them off that, however attractive the proposition put to them. So this can lead to the new entrant filling its books with the fish John West rejects. That's not necessarily a bad thing, it's just you're probably going to get the worst credits when you go into a new country. It's not obviously unprofitable, but credit quality is almost certainly going to be lower. And to some extent, we had that experience here in the 80s. Alternatively, are flows intermediated by markets more beneficial, whether in the form of bonds or equities? For many years, there has been a marked contrast in the financial structure of the US and most of the rest of the world. So the US is basically a market, mostly a markets financed or intermediated financial system. Basically, all of the rest of the world is a banked financial system, including our own. So we often have a lot of studies which compare Australia to the US and say, well, look how much deeper markets are in the US than they are in Australia. That's true, but that's true of pretty much every country in the world. And the rest of the world looks the same. It's the US, actually, which looks different. So in Australia and Asia, bank-based intermediation has the lion's share of financing. And one consequence of the regulatory reform program after the crisis is that it is intended to increase the cost of bank-intermediated finance. So as a result, market intermediation is increasing, which will have implications for the future of financial integration in Asia. So one piece of evidence of that in this part of the world is the strong issuance of offshore bonds by Asian corporates over the last couple of years. Much of this rise has been driven by Chinese issuers, which now account for about 40% of the bond issuance by Australian non-financial corporates. However, borrowing from banks still represents the vast majority of debt of Asian corporations. Another question that arises is which of these forms of cross-border flows, banking or market-based, are more stable? So this is an issue which gets a lot of attention in this part of the world and will once again come into sharp relief when the Fed raises its policy rate. The increase in cross-border flows into emerging markets over recent years, particularly in the Asian region, has contained a large amount of market-based finance. Asset managers have a much higher share of emerging Asia in their funds today than they did a decade ago. How stable are those flows likely to be in a more volatile environment? What is the behaviour of investors who have allocated a higher share of their portfolio to emerging markets? How much of that increased share is a result of a search for higher yield, which might reverse when yields in traditional developed markets increase? How much of it is a structural and permanent diversification into the emerging world as the emerging world becomes a much larger share of the global economic and financial landscape? Again, there's some of the questions which I think this sort of work needs to think about. A major influence on the future path of financial integration in this part of the world will be developments in Chinese financial markets. So China is on a path of financial deregulation and capital account liberalisation. Almost no other country, in fact, I think probably no other country, has managed this process without encountering significant problems. And of course, we did ourselves. So China has endeavoured to learn the lessons from all the other countries that have gone down this path, including ourselves. But it would be a significant achievement if they are able to pull it off without encountering some problems. So investing in Chinese domestic markets has become easier over the past year, with a range of new initiatives gradually opening up the capital account. At this stage, primarily by allowing more portfolio flows between Hong Kong and the mainland. So the new schemes expand the avenues for investing in Chinese domestic debt and equity markets from the existing RQFII and QFII programs, which at the end of May accounted for around $140 billion of foreign investment in China. The Shanghai-Hong Kong Stock Connect scheme, which started in November last year, is about at half its northbound capacity, i.e. Hong Kong up into China, of around $50 billion. A Shenzhen-Hong Kong Stock Connect is expected to be announced soon. The mutual recognition of funds agreement effective from July will allow fund managers registered in Hong Kong to offer investment fund products to mainland residents and vice versa. So as China opens up its capital account in both directions, its potential for vast flows, the flows are already there, they're just intermediated by SAFE at the moment. SAFE may have different investing preferences from the rest of the Chinese population. So as the Chinese population gets to do what they want rather than whatever SAFE wants, the nature of those financial flows might actually change. But similarly, the opportunity to actually invest in China through a much broader range of products is going to change the nature of financial integration in this region quite dramatically. So from an Australian perspective, these avenues should provide an opportunity for Australian banks, asset managers and their clients to increase their exposure to the Chinese domestic financial market. So Australian international portfolio investment has been growing strongly over recent years, from around $450 billion in 2010 to over $750 billion at the end of 2014. One thing which hasn't been remarked on all that much is that Australia actually has a net asset position now. So we actually invest more offshore in equity markets than the foreigners invest in the Australian equity market. That's been true only for about the last year or so. So while the share of Asian bond investment has risen a little over that period, the share of investment in Asian equities has been largely steady. And in terms of Australian investment in this region, both remain at well below 10% of total portfolio investment in offshore markets. So Asia is very underweight in Australian investment portfolio, asset managers' portfolios. So there appear to be significant scope for further financial integration with the region. So let me finish by saying that the work by the ACFS on financial integration in Asia is focusing on an area of significant importance today and one that's probably going to become even more important over the next few years. There are many issues to discuss, and I've thrown out a couple of issues which I think are worth thinking about as well, but there are plenty more of them in the volume which is sitting in front of you. So the briefing paper, which is there, is a promising start, and I wish them well for the project over the next few years. So, thanks.
Look, I'm going to open the questions to the floor in a moment. I just want to ask Guy one question about the RMB Clearing Bank and the impact that that might have on Australia's, or actually on China's capital account and Australia's trade with China. I'm interested in your perspectives on that, Guy, and just how significant the RMB clearing process is for Australia.
I don't want to undersell it, but as a customer, you actually don't notice the difference too much, because if you go into a bank, they will give you, it's basically a question of when you get value as much as anything. So you get it quicker now than you would have prior to its establishment. But as a customer, it doesn't actually make too much difference. I think it's more around just the profile which comes from its existence as much as what it actually does for you. So I don't want to undersell it, because it is a reasonably important part of infrastructure. But if you walk into your bank and say, here's my account, I want to pay someone on the mainland, then actually what you're talking about is the plumbing behind that. And most people don't have any idea about the plumbing behind any of their transactions in Australian dollars, let alone RMB. And that for good reason. They don't need to. But that's what it's about, is about improving the plumbing behind the front end. But you, from a customer point of view, doesn't necessarily, you don't see it so much. It's more the bank that you're dealing with, it will matter. It matters to them in terms of them being able to potentially, being able to offer you a better service or a cheaper service potentially. But as a customer, you're not going to see too much. It's more just going to give you, it's going to be faster speed in terms of, and more confidence about being able to see the money in your account basically.
Hi Andrew, Rob Dougal. You made a very interesting remark about the lack of our investment into Asia, and I just wonder whether that's because there's still barriers to entry for Australian companies to invest in Asia. I was particularly aware of a situation when one of the Australian banks wanted to reopen and get a banking license back into Thailand, and they'd been there once before and had pulled out because of economic circumstances. And I don't know that we actually get yet the Asian culture that was seen as a slap in the face. So the regulatory authority in Thailand decided that they would make that bank wait a bit longer, because they'd been there and they'd left and they wanted to come back. They were going to make them wait to come back because they hadn't been loyal and stayed in the country through the tough times.
Yeah.
So there's a lot about, I think, Australian companies learning about the Asian way, and the Asian way is really long-term relationships. I just thought I'd open that up to the panel, because we've obviously got to, if we're investing in those countries, we need to understand the culture that we've got in those countries.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question, Rob. I mean, you make a very good point, and it's actually one that we addressed in the Passing Us By report. I think it's fair to say that we don't understand Asia, and it's probably also fair to say that Asians don't really understand us either. And so there is a very significant piece there, which is a cultural divide. There's also no question that business is done very differently as well. And there are risks. I couldn't honestly sit here and say that there are not risks. There are. The challenge is, how do you manage those risks? And you've pointed to the need for long-term thinking about how we go about things. I think Amy sort of touched on that and the question that I asked her as well, in our relatively short-term decision-making cycles, which is driven by shareholder demands, analysts' requirements, and things like that. But I think if we are to take advantage of the opportunity, and the opportunity is immense, and we've heard, you know, Amy sort of articulate that pretty clearly, then we do have to get much more comfortable with doing business in Asia, in that environment. We won't change their environment. We have to get used to doing business in their world. So I'd be interested in Hugh, Guy, your perspectives perhaps on that question too.
Look, and really only to reinforce the points that have been made, frankly. I mean, it is a different way of doing business. Australia is at the moment, you know, other than a few companies that really stand out, and AMP's in the room and you know, putting a lot of effort into Asia, it's something that has been well down the list for a long time. And you know, my view, Andrew keeps on reminding me, you know, four out of the five biggest economies by 2030 are going to be here, Indonesia being the fourth, right? And so in that sense, it is the obvious no regrets sort of move, even if with relatively little investment, at least to be building some experience, some expertise, some cultural understanding. And I think, you know, there's a sense in which we all need to be spruiking that story, frankly.
I think it gets to the point also about whether you go in as a joint venture or whether you go in on your own bat. And Jeff was talking about this earlier in terms of AMP. If you're going in as a joint venture, then it seems to me that's one way you have more chance of getting around some of those or dealing with some of those cultural issues, because the person you're partnering with presumably, you know, has got the culture. Whereas if you're going in cold, then it seems that would seem to me that the risks are potentially larger. I mean, there are other challenges which come with a joint venture, but at least if that you perceive that as a particularly large barrier, then that potential, you know, then going in jointly rather than on your own is one way to get around that.
If I can add to that, I think, Rob, one of the really important points in your question is, and we can never forget, you know, Asia is not one place. It's a set of numerous, quite different and large markets. And one of the challenges when we say integrate with Asia is that you're trying to integrate with, say, 12 markets that are all individually regulated and highly diverse. At the end of the day, that's quite expensive to try to deal with every single set of legislative and regulatory requirements you need to get the licensing in a particular country. Thailand is one example, you know, but there are many others, and I'm certainly familiar with the case of the bank that you're speaking about. I will say that, you know, I think to Hugh's point, there are some things that the Australian government and regulatory authorities could do on this side to make it a little bit easier and reduce the expense of that in terms of treatment of capital weightings and that sort of thing, for example, for joint ventures. But the fact remains that, you know, one of the ongoing and reality is the challenge is addressing so many individual markets.
I've always been told I had a loud American voice and didn't need a mic. Amy, you pointed out that China is the most restrictive services market in the world. Who are we benchmarking ourselves against? Is there somebody who's getting it right, Japan, Korea? Move Hong Kong aside, because I think that's a special case, Singapore. So to you or to any of the panel members, is there, in terms of financial integration, who's doing it better than Australia? Who's getting it right? What are they doing, and what does it look like?
David, I think that's an excellent question, and it gets to one of the more important question that Guy raised, which is what is the optimal level of integration? You know, are we pursuing free trade just for the sake of free trade? I will kind of make a point that, I mean, you could even count the number of papers and studies that have been done by Australian economists, trade economists, estimating the gains from trade liberalization for trade in goods. There is a much thinner, almost non-existent, actually, body of work of a similar vein looking at the potential gain from trade and services. We just haven't focused on it enough. So I think a lot of those questions are unanswered, which is one of the points we're trying to bring forward. That OECD measure is one of the kind of technically correct ways to measure trade. It looks at all legislative and regulatory barriers. It's actually an Australian innovation. It's an Australian academic who came up with that methodology that was adopted by the Productivity Commission, and then into the OECD. So it's simply saying this is the average regulatory stance or legislative stance, and here are countries that are either above or below, and China's way above. So it's sort of, it is what it is. A judgment around that, I think China would say it certainly worked for them. They're probably not in a position to quickly lower that because they have a lot of work to do domestically. But it does indicate how tough it is to enter that market.
But, I mean, one thing about the clearing bank, I mean, and the number of other initiatives over the last year or two in terms of us versus other countries and the possibilities in China is the fact that we have a clearing bank, with the fact that we have the swap. I mean, a lot of that stuff looks mostly like symbolism, but it actually is a demonstration that the Chinese are interested in our engagement into China as against other countries. So there's, I mean, the sort of order in which you get access to those sort of things is an indication of the way they're perceiving you potentially as providing an opportunity. So if you're trying to stack yourself, you know, as Amy said, there are plenty of barriers there. They're being lowered. They're not necessarily being lowered across the board. They're actually being lowered selectively, sort of region by region. And if you're one of the countries who are benefiting from that selective lowering of those barriers, and in a number of cases we are, and the clearing bank again is one, that's an indication of providing, that gives you a leg up over other regions in terms of access to that market.
Thank you. Martine Letts from the Australia-China Business Council. Good place to finish maybe on the question of governance versus culture. So we talk a lot about the importance of understanding the cultures, mutual understanding of cultures and relationships, and yet it is clear that ways of doing business do differ. Does that include an attitude towards good governance? Amy, you said that we are a good model for governance, but is our governance model too tough, too restrictive? Are we facing partners who have a looser attitude to that, and is there a possibility that the two cultures will be bridged in any way?
Well, I mean, I'm happy to kick off, but I'd welcome comments. I mean, look, there's no question that Australia has very high governance standards on a whole range of dimensions, and there's certainly no question that one of both the real and the perceived issues for Australians is this whole question of, you know, bribery, corruption, all of that stuff, and it's part of the reason why we advocate, you know, very much a stepwise approach, because people have to figure out how the system works, but not get into the system in that sense. Stay apart from that, and that's difficult in practice, and it's difficult, you know, in a strict governance sense as well. So, you know, we've talked a lot about. There have been a couple of questions, you know, how does Australia position ourselves? You know, what's best practice? Where, you know, I think the point, we've got to keep on coming back to the point here, that Australia's got to run its own race, right? We're both in Asia and we're not within Asia. You know, we're different in many ways, all of that stuff, but we've got to find our own path. You know, I'm not quite sure we're getting there quick enough, actually, but you know, that's not a new thought. I think, you know, part of our answer has to be not to drop our standards on governance, right? And I think that's got to be, you know, a non-negotiable. And if that means that some stuff comes more slowly than you know people would like, then we're just, you know, we've got to be able to stand up and articulate why that's the case and stick to our guns, basically.
I think the other issue is about what differentiates us potentially from the US and Europe, and why this matters much more in asset management than in banking, where, no offence to the bankers in the room, but not clear that we actually have a particularly different proposition to be offering than any other number of other banks. But in asset management industry, partly because of our size and partly, as Amy said, because of the different model, that is something which is a different proposition to be offering. And also, because we're not European, we're not going to impose it like a US model might, and or it's not going to be a European model which ends up, you know, being overly has the possibility of being overly regulated. So the Australian model is somewhere in between those. So we're not going to impose it on someone necessarily. And it's more, here's a model which you can adopt rather than here's something we're going to make you adopt. I think that's partly the difference about where we're coming from as a middle-sized country or smaller country rather than the US or the European approach, which may be more saying, okay, this is what we expect you to do.
Yep.
We're saying, here's what we do. Maybe you might be interested in that. And I think that's a different way of going about it. Doesn't mean you have to drop your standards. You're actually just saying, here's something which you might want to think about doing.
Yep.
We can do that for you rather than saying, we're going to come into your country and this is the way it's going to be done.
I think that's very well put. There's no question, you know, I spent a lot of time in Asia, in a whole lot of different institutions, and Australians are regarded, even though they're going to be polite to me, right? But Australians are genuinely regarded, we are seen in many ways as the good guys, and particularly to pick up Guy's point, because we're, you know, we're not in the imposition department. I disagree. The only point I'd pick you up on, Guy, is I think we are at an interesting point now. I do think the Australian banks have an opportunity to be differentiating around some of the technology. That's a work in progress, but I do think if we pick that up right, we could actually help to provide more of a differentiated proposition in that market as well.
Guy, just one final question before we wrap up. So it seems timely to ask a question about free trade agreements now as well. You know, within the last 12 months, three very significant free trade agreements concluded. Just you touched on it briefly in some comments you made earlier, but just how significant should we see those agreements being in terms of our, if you like, reputation in Asia and the way that governments and companies in Asia might view Australia?
So I'm afraid you have strayed right out of sight my field of expertise here.
Right.
So,
okay, sorry.
Notwithstanding, I used to, Chris Fidlay was one of my professors back in the day, who maybe was referring to earlier. But so no, I'm afraid I'll let you answer that question rather than me, because I don't know enough about the way that's all going.
Amy, would you care to go, or Hugh, do you
want to? Well, I'm happy to have a, I mean,
if, have a crack.
Well, look, I mean, I'm sort of enough of a conventional economist to think anything that's taking us closer to free trade is probably a good thing. You know, obviously, first prize would be multilateral trade stuff, but that seems a step too far. So I think that's right, Martine. and so, you know, individual free trade deals are a second or a third best option and should be pursued. Of course, the reality is that, you know, they can deal with barriers at one level, but it doesn't deal with a lot of the more regulatory, more hidden barriers that we know are real. But it's basically a step in the right direction and I, you know, frankly, I hope it continues.
I'd like to, if I can make one comment about, actually two comments. One is that I think one of the things that may end up surprising the Australian community about the free trade agreements is that there will be at least a large of an impact coming into the Australian economy as there will be going out. Meaning the opportunities, we can't forget, are for two-way trade and investment. It's not all about Australian exports and Australian outbound investment. This is opening up further potential for inbound investment because, and the Chinese in particular, use free trade to help drive a domestic reform agenda, and the domestic reform agenda in China is about the financial services sector. So we shouldn't sort of close our eyes to that. You know, I think it's quite important to remember. After China, what the government is working on now is a services agreement with India. India is a much larger services economy already than China, so that will also be a very important agreement. But what we're missing, and getting back to kind of the point of what we're saying in our paper, is at this point we don't even necessarily have the underlying data at hand for China, and definitely not for India, to understand the magnitude of that agreement, to be able to estimate properly what it's going to mean for the Australian economy. So I sort of come back to the premise that we really do need to develop our data and our research and our understanding of what these flows and our trade and services mean so that we can demonstrate the costs and benefits of lowering these barriers over time for ourselves as well as our trade partners.
That's a great point.